Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Today, welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel. And today we are pleased and indeed an honor to have with us Master Historian Jeremy Black. Professor Black is Professor Emeritus at the University of Exeter in the Department of History. And today we are discussing one of his newest books, A Brief History of the Atlantic, published by Robinson. Welcome, Professor Black.
Hello.
Professor, why did you write this book?
Well, I've been trying to write for Robinson a series of shortish, well, they're 80,000 words, they're not that short, but shortish, accessible books on major areas and topics, and to do so without feeling constrained by the academic conventions of footnotes and discussing historiography. I started that some time ago with a book in on slavery and another one on British history from since 1851. I've done ones for them, of course, on Italy, Portugal, Spain, and Germany, and on London. And I've also tackled a number of bodies of water and the societies around them. So I started on the Mediterranean, which we discussed on your program, and followed that with the Caribbean, which we likewise discussed. And now I've followed with the Atlantic, and indeed I have one on the Pacific, which is forthcoming. And I find it instructive because I think one simultaneously needs to discuss the ocean, varying from its geology to the issues involved in crossing it, from its fish life to its climate, but also how far these brought together or did not bring together the societies around their shores.
When, historically speaking, did the Atlantic emerge?
Here we're talking about very much in deep geological time, which I do go in with the in the book. But I think from my point of view, I'm most concerned with the human experience of the Atlantic. And there, what I would say is we're really talking about when people were able to cross it. I think prior to that, it is simply a large coastal water of possibly, uncertain space. It's the edge of the oceans. It's the edge of the world. You don't know what is going to happen. And I discuss in the book, for example, Dante's Inferno, sails into the ocean, etc., notions like Atlantis and the Phoenicians. To my mind, although there has been a lot of speculation about other societies crossing the Atlantic and novels accordingly, I mean, the popular novelist, for example, Clive Cussler, has some of his characters, some of his Romans crossed. In my mind, I don't see any crossing. You've got the sort of, as it were, Viking diaspora or Odyssey or whatever you wish to talk about it. And there you have a definite crossing, first via Iceland to Greenland, and then from Greenland on to North America, to Labrador. But I think it's fair to say that the Norse experience and the medieval Norse attitudes to the world. They had an idea of the world as in four quarters, with the Atlantic as the western quarter. I think it's fair to say that that did not have much of an influence in Europe as a whole, Christian Europe as a whole, let alone in other parts of the Atlantic. And we see no comparable activity in terms of sailing eastwards across the Atlantic, although there are, of course, ocean currents, most famously the Gulf Stream, which would facilitate just such a transit.
Why did the Romans or the Greeks, for that matter, not cross the Atlantic?
Well, that's, again, an excellent question. I mean, it's very difficult to explain something that does not happen. I mean, as far as the Greeks are concerned, Greek access to the Atlantic is rather limited. The Mediterranean, the pre-Roman Mediterranean people that are most active there are the Phoenicians. And, of course, the Phoenicians definitely sailed in the Atlantic. And as you may know, Herodotus reported that the Phoenicians circumnavigated Africa in about 600 BCE. And there has been an attempt to use Phoenicia, which is a 20-meter-long replica of a Phoenician ship, in order to show that the Atlantic could have been crossed that way. That attempt was made in 2019. But I think it's fair to say that although there are modern claims of Phoenician remains in Brazil, notably tools, inscriptions, and linguistic influences, they're all highly problematic. And I think what we can only safely say is the Phoenicians definitely traded up the eastern seaboard of the Atlantic as far as Britain for the its production that would help the in bronze. It was Bronze Age civilization. And the Phoenicians definitely had a major base at Gades, or what we would call Cadiz, from about 800 BCE. But I don't actually see, although there is discussion that Hanno the Navigator may have reached as far as the Canaries or Gabon, I don't think there's much evidence of it, and nor for that matter of the Carthaginians, which were a Phoenician colony, reaching the Azores. As far as the Romans are concerned, again, there is Roman naval activity and commercial activity in the European waters of the Atlantic. Caesar, for example, developed ships to fight the Veneti of southern Brittany, and he wrote about their ship. And the Romans, of course, crossed the English Channel. Allegedly, there was a circumnavigation of Britain in 83 or 84 CE by a Roman fleet. But there's no extension to further islands, whether Ireland or Scotland, let alone Norway into the North Atlantic. Evidence of the Romans trading with the Canaries, and both Plutarch and Pliny describe the Canaries. But I think that's about as far as one could say that the Romans definitely went. And you ask what implicit in your question is why they didn't go any further. And I'm not sure there was either opportunity or need. And I think the two of those often are coterminous, as it were. And I don't really see that the Romans had a strong impulse in that direction. And I would underline that by the fact we're not just talking about a single period of 20, 50 or 70 years. We're talking about the entire period of Roman presence on the seaboard, which was one of over four centuries.
Now, in terms of opportunity and need, would it be correct to say that helps to explain why American Indians did not traverse the Atlantic in the opposite direction from west to east?
Yes, I think that's, again, a very good point. I mean, clearly there were native peoples who were able to navigate coastal waters off what we would now call Canada, and indeed on the United States, in order to fish, and in particular, in the case of Canada, to hunt hunt for the, you know, the sea mammals, seals, for example, walruses, and the Vikings in Greenland were to encounter Inuits, which obviously suggests a degree of eastern movement, though in this respect, one's looking at Greenland being not particularly far from the Canadian islands. But there's no evidence that I am aware of, I'm quite happy to be corrected, that there was a movement any further east. And, you know, one's got to be aware that these seas are difficult. They're difficult in terms of navigation, and they're also difficult in terms of their waters. Now, if you look at the Pacific, as we know, our Micronesian and Melanesian peoples went a long way across the Southwest and finally into the Southeast Pacific, and also into the Central Pacific, obviously, the Hawaiian archipelago. I think it's fair to say that the navigational difficulties in the Atlantic were much, much greater. The seas, for example, between Iceland and the Faroe Islands are particularly stormy. And you've got to put up with about 1,000 miles, about 1,600 kilometers of storm-tossed waters in that area. And then you move further west for the waters between between Iceland and Greenland, which are also very tough. So I think it's fair to say that there were issues in opportunity and need. You have not got overpopulation or population pressures that we know of in the eastern seaboard of the United States and modern-day Canada, nor for that matter in Brazil. There is not a strong tradition of building ships that would have gone any great distance. I mean, I discuss in my book on the Caribbean that there is Maya trading into the Caribbean, but there's no suggestion that that trading moved beyond the Caribbean.
And of course, it would be correct to say that you don't regard seriously the claims made in the last 20 years that China during the Ming Dynasty crossed the Pacific.
No, I mean, I think that's a fantasy. I mean, I remember when I was visiting once a London book track, and they had the book there by, and I think it's an Australian engineer who wrote a book about the Chinese reaching Florence, I think, in 1431. And I just said to the store manager that that should be in the fiction section, not in the history section. So, no, I don't think it's plausible. Chinese vessels of the early 15th century had waters of the Indian Ocean. They definitely reached the eastern seaboard of Africa, but there's no evidence that they crossed, for example, the South Atlantic.
Why did the Iberians cross the Atlantic? Iberians, of course, I'm talking about the Spanish and the Portuguese.
Yes. Well, again, a really interesting question. Partly that is the projection of their already Christian expansionism, the sense of messianic mission built into that, which you see in particular in the circle around Henry the Navigator, the extent to which already in the 15th century, they've conquered, in the case of Spaniards, the Castilians, they've conquered the Canary Islands, the way in which the Portuguese have began to settle Madeira in 1420. So in many respects, there is, if one wants to think about it geographically, a southward movement along the Atlantic coast in Africa, beginning with the capture of Ceuta by the Portuguese in 1415. Considerable extent, the engagement with what we would call the Americas, including Brazil, is in many respects a collateral, a sequence, an overlap with this more important thrust down along Africa with the attempt to gain gold, the attempt to find a route to India, the attempt to in some way a link up maybe with Prester John, the Christian ruler of Abyssinia, and regain Jerusalem and usher in the second coming of Christ. So that is all very important in Iberian thought and activity. And what that does is ensure that already there's an allocation of provisional with the Treaty of Tordesillas of 1494. Is most famous based on Alexander VI's division of the Atlantic and the New World between Portugal and Spain. But already there had been the Portuguese and the Spaniards already in a treaty of 1479, in other words, before Columbus had sailed, had already, as it were, sought to arrange their corresponding interests in the Eastern Atlantic. And I think that in a sense, we sort of treat the story as beginning with Columbus. It doesn't begin with Columbus at all.
Now, would it be correct to say that with their trade with China, the entrepot of the Philippines, that the Iberians evolved a sort of world system of trade at this period?
Yes, I think it's fair to say that in the 16th century, exactly as you say, I mean, it takes place in a number of stages. There's the establishment of Iberian power in the Americas and the development of bullion production there. And bullion, of course, enables you to finance negative trade balances, as it does today. The subsequent Spanish establishment from the 1560s of a base in the Philippines. The Philippines already has commercial links with China, or from their commercial links with China can be pursued. And you get, as you are implying, the development of the so-called Manila Galleon, the sailing from Acapulco to Manila and then back again, carrying one million and the other way Chinese goods. And separate to that, the Portuguese had already developed Macau from the 1520s trade there with China, just as they developed in the 1550s a commercial presence at Nagasaki for trade with the Japanese. So exactly as you say, there is the development of a global trade links, and that gives the Atlantic an additional significance because the Atlantic is the approach through which the Iberians, and indeed after the Iberians, the Dutch, English, and French, trade into the Indian Ocean, because obviously the route to it through through the Middle East is closed by Ottoman power. And also, although there is, from Magellan onwards, voyages round south of South America, the easiest way to trade with the Pacific is not those hazardous and distant waters, but in fact to trade across the Atlantic, across the Caribbean, and then you would either trade from the Isthmus of Darien, with Panama Canal roughly zone, I mean obviously the canal comes much later, down to Peru and take up the silver from Potosi, or you would trade across Mexico and then trade across the Pacific into East Asia. Now, Columbus's vision, of course, had been to trade to Asia across the Atlantic. I mean, he discovers that the world, you know, he understood the Greek perception of the world as a sphere. The Greeks got wrong the size of the sphere, so the Americas are, as it were, explored. The locals didn't need to be discovered. They knew they were there. It's explored as a intermediate landmass, and they initially hope there will be a sea passage between North America and South America. They discover there isn't. But in a sense, it is the Colombian vision, if you like, of getting to Asia by going westwards that helps to provide a great significance for the Atlantic, although that significance is to become much more important than had been envisaged because of these two new continents, North and South America, that are A, explored, and B, that are then economically developed.
And why did the period of Iberian dominance expire?
Well, Iberian dominance, in one respect, is still there. There is still Latin American culture and a Latin American presence to an extent that is greater than that of many other European empires elsewhere in the world. But in terms of formal political control, I think one's looking really at the enormously disruptive consequences of the Napoleonic Wars, which really create a fundamental crisis for the Spanish and indeed Portuguese imperial monarchies. But it's also contingent factors play a role. I mean, in a sense, in the late 18th century, prior to that, under Charles III of Spain, I think it's fair to say that Spanish America is developing and is strong to an extent that most people subsequently who are so brought up on the decline of Spain don't realize. So it's worth bearing in mind that if you're looking at 18th century a new world, the empire that collapses is not the Spanish Empire, it's the French Empire. France loses Nova Scotia and its claims in Newfoundland to the British early on. It loses New France, and in other words, most of what is now modern-day Quebec, which it cedes in 1760. It loses most of its islands, though not the key islands but most of its islands in the 1760s, then again the 1790s, and finally Louisiana is sold in 1803. So it's the French Empire that goes first in the Americas, but the Spanish Empire rapidly follows, or the Spanish Empire on the continental mainland. Spain is still an imperial power in the Caribbean, in Cuba and in Puerto Rico till 1898. Same with Portugal. I mean, people tend to think of Portugal as a weak power. Actually, Portugal was doing quite well in the 18th century. It preserved its independence from Spain. It had aligned itself with the economy of the leading Atlantic economic power, Britain. But again, what you've got is the disruption of the early 19th century combined with divisions in the Portuguese royal family. And you end up with two branches of the Portuguese royal family, one in Portugal, one in Brazil, the Brazilian one identifying with Brazil. Brazil becomes an empire, of course, and then that ends with republicanism. I think it's still fair to say that there is a Portuguese presence culturally to this day in Brazil. And there was a Portuguese Atlantic in the 19th century, which people tend to underrate. I mean, Portugal had colonies in Africa, Portuguese Guinea, and much more prominently Angola. It had islands in the Atlantic, the Azores, Madeira, the Cape Verde Islands. And although it wasn't anymore the territorial ruler of Brazil, Brazil was still part of the Portuguese world. And it's interesting to think about how we tend to underrate the South Atlantic. I mean, most commentary is from, as it were, British scholars or French scholars or American scholars, and their account of Atlantic history is very much devoted to the North Atlantic. Actually, the South Atlantic is of enormous importance. And you can see this analogously with one of the modern topics that create great interest, understandably great interest, which is the slave trade and slave economies and the end of slavery. And you could read the stuff and be under the impression that Virginia or Georgia were the centers of slavery, which of course is absolute rubbish. The leading slave economy throughout in the New World was Brazil, and the leading trade throughout was the supply of Brazil, notably the two major supply routes from Angola and then from West Africa. And again, that tends to be underrated. There are good books. You know, I'm not saying there's nobody written on it, but there are. But the fact of the matter is there is far, far, far less written on the southern Atlantic than there is on the northern Atlantic.
Why do the British become the hegemonic Atlantic power, and why for so long, unlike, say, the Dutch?
I think the British become the hegemonic Atlantic power partly because of the failure of France and the failure, as you mentioned, of the Dutch, partly because the other powers are more committed to land conflict, and they only have so many military resources and they focus on the land, partly because of happenstance that, in a sense, the British or the English before them, who, for example, in the early 16th century under Henry VIII had not devoted much attention to the Atlantic. Henry VIII had preferred to pursue goals on the continent. Changed their priorities. And in looking at that, you might talk about the rise of mercantile values in the political sphere, particularly in the late 17th and 18th centuries, and with that, the commitment to a large navy and the commitment to sound and accountable public finances, all of which serve as the basis for and protection of a effective commercial system.
How did travel and travel times change in the 19th and early 20th centuries?
Well, in the 19th century, the principal travel change comes from steam and steaming the ocean. I mean, obviously, one can think of its more somber aspects, such as I discussed the Titanic, for example. But steam provided predictable sailing times and also actually the economies of scale. So you get the much larger ships being produced, you know, in Rudyard Kipling, in his poem Rolling Down to Rio from 1902, refers to weekly from Southampton, great steamers, white and gold, go rolling down to Rio. And, you know, that was literally the case. So you could guarantee transits, and there was a lot of investment into developing the large ships, which iron ships with Parsons marine turbines and such like, and really sort of lines like the White Star. I mean, obviously the Titanic was a White Star one. It was running a weekly service to New York from Southampton from 1907, for example. So you've got that. And then in the early 20th century, of course, you get the development of air services. Initially, flying boats are important from the mid-1920s. You can go from London to Cape Town. You can go from Stuttgart to Natal in Brazil. The latter, the stops include Bathurst in Gambia. You could go from Svelte in Germany via Iceland and Greenland to New York in 1930, and I noted that was 47 flight hours. There are airships, of course, that go across the Atlantic. The first non-stop transatlantic commercial flight was the Graf Zeppelin in 1928, and that goes from Friedrichshafen, which is on Lake Constance, to Lakehurst, New Jersey, and that took 112 hours in 1928. The return, when you've got westerly winds, the thing you still get, obviously taking a big influence today, was 72 hours. By 1930, the British R-100 airship is taking 78 hours to go from Bedfordshire to Montreal. And then, of course, you get the movement into commercial aircraft services. So those are begin just before World War II, between New York and London, and then they're obviously stopped during the war, and then they resume immediately after the war. and they then are speeded up when you've got the development of jet services. So jet aircraft, you get those from 1958 on the Atlantic services with the Boeing 707 and the DC-8, and they took 7 hours to cross the Atlantic. I mean, obviously, that was to be cut even further in a way that we no longer have when you had the supersonic Concorde, and that enters service in 1976. But, you know, you can now, I mean, prior to COVID, going from New York to London was like a bus service in the evening. You know, there were flights more regularly than every half an hour.
How was the Great War fought in the Atlantic?
The Great War was fought in the Atlantic essentially as a war against submarines. There was one major fleet action, and again, you know, we tend to forget the South Atlantic. That was the Battle of the Falkland Islands in 1914 when British battle cruisers engaged the German Pacific fleet, which had come had sunk a weaker British force off Coronel in Chile. It sails into the Atlantic in order to destroy the wireless station at Port Stanley in the Falklands and to seize the coal there in the coaling depot. But the British had sent two very powerful battle cruisers down there, the Invincible and the Inflexible, and they destroy the German force. After that, it's submarines. There are the occasional German disguised merchantmen acting as a commerce raider, but in effect, it's submarines, and they produce a significant effect. With, you know, by early 1917, the British losing over 600,000 tonnage of shipping a month to German submarines, a relatively minimal loss of German submarines. But the introduction from that May 1917 of escorted convoys cuts the shipping losses dramatically, as well as leading to the increase of in the sinking of submarines. And as a result of that, the Atlantic ceases to be of strategic significance. So, for example, the Americans move over 2 million troops to Europe abroad on top of thousands of ships, and only 68 soldiers are drowned as a result of those U-boat attacks. So, in other words, the U-boat war had lost its strategic significance, and the Allies had won it.
And how was the Second World War fought in the Atlantic?
Well, the Second World War has parallels. I mean, the German surface warships have a longer presence. One can think of the Graf Spee, which is a pocket battleship raiding Commerce in 1939. One can think, I mean, you know, the other ships like the Gneisenau and the Scharnhorst went over. One can think in particularly of the Bismarck in 1941, and which was a, you know, it was had 8 15-inch guns, which would have been enough to take out convoy escorts, but it is sunk in May 1941, and really, and of course the German the German surface shipping left in Brest, then moves in early 1942. Is moved back into German waters. So thereafter, again, it's a submarine war and an anti-submarine war, conversely, for the Allies, one in which the use of air power proves more significant than in World War One. Air power in terms of spotting and then dropping depth charges against against the German submarines, and the closure of the mid-Atlantic so-called air gap to the west of the Azores in October 1943, when Portugal, which was neutral, allowed first the British and then the Americans to establish air bases, was absolutely crucial in winning that.
Why did British hegemony in the Atlantic end? And if you had to give a date, what year would that be?
Well, I think British hegemony ended because of the exhaustion of Britain, the decline of its empire, and the rise of the United States. If I was giving a date for that, I think I would probably put it on 1944. The American Navy becomes more prominent. America is much richer. Britain is bankrupt. Britain, of course, continued to have colonial possessions in the Atlantic, not least, in fact, in 1944. Newfoundland was still in the empire, as were the Bahamas, obviously the British in the positions in the Caribbean, and the British possessions in the southern Atlantic, Tristan da Cunha, Ascension, the Falklands, St. Helena. But in practical terms, America was dominant, and that dominance was to be enhanced after the war. America had far more to offer allies in terms of money, investment, commercial opportunity, military assistance. So, for example, after the war, America is able to develop links with hitherto neutral powers during the war, places like Spain, for example. It's able to strengthen its links with Brazil, where it really supplants earlier British commercial and political influence, same in Argentina, develops its links in Morocco and benefits from the withdrawal of the European and colonial powers. And in a sense, it becomes a struggle between an American-led West and the Soviet sphere, which is present most obviously in Cuba and with the Cuban troops moving with Soviet assistance to Angola and Portuguese Guinea, former Portuguese Guinea, what we would now call Guinea-Bissau. And that becomes the struggle, and that remains the struggle at the present moment. I mean, Venezuela is part of the informal Soviet empire, and of course China adds economic muscle and increasingly political muscle to this confrontation.
Would it be correct to say that as a historian you do not really adhere to the so-called New Atlantic history?
I think there's a lot of weaknesses in much writing of so-called Atlantic history. A lot of it, as I've said, is about the North Atlantic, doesn't know about the South Atlantic. A lot of it is very much focused on themes to do with the British world, and even in the North Atlantic doesn't have very much to say about the French. A lot of it, as the naval historian Nicholas Rogers said to me, was the Atlantic with the ocean left out. In other words, it's often curious. There's often a curious ignorance about the physicality of the ocean and the implications that had for shipping, trade, migration, and other subjects. And I've tried in my book to add all of those in. Now, obviously, if I'd had greater space, it might have been a different book. But I think that within the space available, I think I've tried to capture the, as it were, the naval dimension, and also the extent to which you need to understand. And I tried to do this in the Mediterranean and the Caribbean, the nature of a coastal area, and how that is affected by being on a body of water, and how the opportunities of being on a body of water are affected by what you do on the coast, developing harbours, building communication routes, establishing or not establishing political or military centres there. So I think there is an inherent dynamism there. So yes, I would say this is a better form of Atlantic history, and I certainly have tried to avoid the rather glib and superficial diatribes against racism or other factors that people often see in a very modernistic light without considering the complexity of the varied cultures of Atlantic history or history of any other body of water for that matter.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
I think the importance of Atlantic history in world history, I mean, obviously it's not the largest ocean in the world, the largest is the Pacific, but in terms of the significance of interaction, regular interaction across the ocean, the Atlantic came first, and the political and economic significance of Atlantic powers mean that in order to study world history, we ought to be able to do and put an emphasis on Atlantic history and to remember its complexities.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Black, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cutillo. You've been listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel of New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Black.
Thank you very much.